Hello and welcome to a live Kerfeffi break on the program with Carrie Smith. Today is August 12th, and I'm excited for our live show today. I have two returning guests. Now, these are folks that I've been lucky enough to interview individually, and today I thought I'd bring them back for a live show so we could talk about some of the stuff that's been in the news about gender-affirming care. It is their Kerfeffi break, so even though this is a heavy subject, we encourage frivolity in the chat. We will have a little bit of frivolity. But please welcome my guest today, Colin Wright, who is an evolutionary biologist and journalist, and Christina Buttons, who's a journalist at the Postmillennial. Welcome, guys.
Hey, thank you.
Hi.
I promised we'd have a little bit of fun. I recently did a live show where I don't think we intended to get into this topic, but we touched on it a little bit. And someone started describing one of the surgeries involved, and the whole chat was like, no, stop. We didn't sign up for that. So I know it could be a little heavy, but.
I'm used to it. Every time I like show up in a Clubhouse chat, no matter what they're talking about, it just, everyone starts talking about these issues. So
yeah,
I'm used to it.
So you guys do a lot of work together on the subject of gender identity, gender ideology, what they call gender affirming care. Do you want to start by anybody who's not familiar with you yet, just telling me a little bit about yourselves and what you do?
I guess I can start. So we both are concerned about gender ideology more broadly. I started out talking about people denying the reality of biological sex, and that has sort of spun into, you know, to peek under the hood and what's producing all these crazy ideas about sex being a social construct. And there's this whole underlying edifice that's just like the gender ideology, which denies that, or which asserts that being a boy or a girl or a man or a woman has everything to do with your identity and nothing to do with your biology. And this has led to a lot of really crazy practices like gender affirming care, where a kid can just say that they feel like they're the opposite sex, and then their puberty is blocked and they're given cross-sex hormones. And so we've been really trying to bring this to light, really. The stuff that Christine and I collaborate on are on these case studies where we going into these Facebook groups that are these private groups for parents of trans and non-binary kids. And they're heavily policed. A lot of parents go to these places because their kids are, you know, all of a sudden just said that they're trans, they're non-binary, whatever. The parents go to these groups for advice, because this is what these groups appear to be doing, is helping parents who are distressed about this. But these groups really are just collectively indoctrinating these scared parents into furthering the transition of their kids. So those are the projects we tend to work on. We also have our individual sort of stuff that we each do on our own, but that's sort of the gist of it. I don't know if you wanted to add, Christina,
you write a lot at your Substack. You do cover a lot of these case studies there. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Buttons lives.
Right. We cover case studies on Substack most of the time. And then since I started working for Postmillennial, I've had to devote most of my time to that.
Mm-hmm. So I asked you on specifically because of something that was in the news recently, or that I saw going around, and you said that there were some untruths, I guess, or some things that were incorrect about the story that was being shared. So I wanted to clear up a little bit about what's going on with the Boston Children's Hospital. Let me see if I can share this on my screen. We can start here. So this is my friend. I think you guys know, and we have worked with.
Oh, cool. We've both been on the street with holding signs with him.
Oh yeah, that's an experience. You will get to see some angry people.
Yeah.
I lost 1,500 followers in one day after sharing a sign, a picture of us.
That's a record.
That's the record. Like I lose followers like 300 or 400 at a time sometimes for saying things like there's only two sexes, or we shouldn't cancel each other, or things like that. But that was that day I lost
1,500. I've already gone through, I went through most of my great purging and my great unfriending 4 years ago, but occasionally it still happens. It just depends. So Billboard Chris shared this. This is when I first saw it. He's talking about the Boston Children's Hospital. So he said the Boston Children's Hospital has hidden their video promoting, quote, gender affirming hysterectomies for girls. What are they so ashamed of? Good thing I made a copy. I'm just going to play this little clip that he, tell me if you can hear this.
Gender affirming hysterectomy is very similar to most hysterectomies that occur. A hysterectomy itself is the removal of the uterus, the cervix, which is the opening of the uterus, and the fallopian tubes, which are attached to the sides of the uterus. Some gender-affirming hysterectomies will also include the removal of the ovaries, but that's technically a separate procedure called a bilateral oophorectomy. And not every gender-affirming hysterectomy includes that, and people who are getting gender-affirming hysterectomies do not have to have their ovaries removed.
Sounds like fun.
There's something weird about it, right? The music in the background.
Yeah, and the colorful backgrounds, and they're all like, this is totally normal. You can get your, you can't even, it's not like getting your breasts removed or something outward. It's a hysterectomy. Like, it's so crazy.
Yeah. And I think, go ahead. I think one thing that makes it particularly, I guess, sinister, I would say, is that, you know, a hysterectomy is usually reserved for women who are much older, who have certain reproductive issues, certain problems, hormonal problems that cause their uterus to, you know, maybe it's precancerous or something, or maybe something's happened where it starts to deteriorate. This is a children's hospital. And this isn't just, oh, maybe some kids have, you know, cancer on their cervix or something that would require a hysterectomy. This is a gender affirming hysterectomy. So these are perfectly healthy uteruses that are in kids who have been bought into this ideology that they've been born in the wrong body and that they need to have this organ, which isn't even apparent from the outside. So it's weird how it could be even affirming someone's transgender identity if it's just this internal organ. And it's done on children, perfectly healthy tissue, very functioning. And it's essentially just a complete sterilizing procedure. You get rid of your uterus, you never have children.
8-year-olds, they have to be at least 18.
And they have to be 18. Is that true across the board? Or so let's clear this up.
They go by the WPATH standards of care. And that's 18 is typical. But it's not wrong to say, like, they are promoting these procedures to young people. Like, advertising them and glamorizing them. But then as the story went more viral, it turns from promoting to offering, and that's not entirely accurate.
They're not doing the surgery. They're not removing the uterus on anyone under 18.
Yeah. I mean, okay. They could have exceptions like they said they did for the vaginoplasty. Like, the co-director has said that he will consider younger than 17, and 17 is still young. Like, I don't know of any other gender clinic that offers vaginoplasty to anyone under 18. They offer it to 17 and possibly younger. They offer chest surgeries. 15-year-old is usually the standard.
Yeah. It's important to note too that these are guidelines that is given by WPATH, but individual doctors are able to sort of use their discretion on individual cases, which is in the case of like
the vaginoplasty, they can sort of
in many cases, if they want to have these surgeries, all that's required is just like, you know, we need a letter from two gender affirming therapists or something like that. And there, something we've discovered too is there's networks of these types of therapists and people who will like sign off on these letters. Mm-hmm. They have a whole network of people designed just to do that. And, you know, send me these dysphoric kids and we'll make sure they get a letter with as few obstacles to surgery as possible. So,
right. There's Gallup. Gallup is an organization that there's about like 400 therapists who have made this public pledge to go around like their states guideline or law even to write gender affirming letters to patients they've never met before. They're supposed to establish like a relationship with a patient and be seeing them for 1 year and vouch for them and say like, yes, they've been my patient and they've had gender dysphoria for at least a year, which isn't very long. Gender dysphoria used to be something that, you know, like you could find it in some children, but like people who are like have rapid onset gender dysphoria, like that's, it's still nuts to me that people are even considering removing healthy breast tissue and things like that. Or even the vaginoplasty, those procedures, the general procedures, they say you have to have a minimum of 1 year living as your gender, the preferred gender.
Well, speaking of breast tissue and removing that, that's something they will do. I'm not sure about Boston Children's Hospital, but I know there are places in the U.S. that will do a double mastectomy on someone younger than 18. There was a clinic here in Texas that was doing it on kids as young as 13. Is that right?
15, yeah, is what they say they perform.
15.
That's the guideline, but there is data that that they've given these surgeries to kids. I've heard 13. I've seen graphs that Jesse Single has shown from a lot of clinics, and they have like the age of the times that kids were given these double mastectomies, and there were a healthy amount of people who were 13 years old who were getting these. Different states have different sort of laws. There's some like Oregon has this like affirmative consent law where you can just, you know, you don't need to have your parents sign off on anything. You can walk in there. I think it's 15, but then it can be younger if you have, you know, both your parents' consent and the child being willing to sign up.
This is a hospital too that brags repeatedly on their website about being the first pediatric surgery center that has a whole suite of surgeries offered to teens. I mean, what I could find was the breast augmentation for males and double mastectomy for females.
This is your piece from the Postmillennial. And for anyone who's just listening, the headline is Boston Children's Hospital gleefully encourages surgical, pharmaceutical, gender transition for teens. Right. And in this piece, you talk about that, how they boast all over their online presence about having the first pediatric transgender surgery center, offering, quote, a full suite of surgical options for transgender teens.
And they've performed surgeries on at least 1,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah. What's really interesting is when you showed Billboard Chris's tweet, he was responding to the fact that after he posts these to Twitter, you know, they had, I think, 90 videos on this playlist about gender affirming surgeries, including the one about the gender affirming hysterectomies. Sounds crazy just saying that phrase, but we tried to go back and I was trying to watch some of these videos and I realized that a lot of them had been set to private. So 41 out of the 90 that were up there are now set to private in response to this sort of, you know, eliciting this backlash, and which is raises the question, is like, if this is just really good health information for kids and there's nothing to worry about, like why are people scrambling to take these things down? Like, it kind of shows that maybe they think something's wrong going on here, maybe a little bit of guilt. I don't know. I mean, it's really bizarre the sort of way that they're trying to sort of memory hole some of these videos.
Yeah, they hid 41, you said, of 90 videos. So
I can't see any of them. I don't know. Some of us can't. The playlist is blocked completely.
What are they ashamed of? His tweet was exactly right. If this is something to brag about that you offer this, why hide it when people start looking for it?
You know, it's the same thing in the Facebook groups, because we make sure to keep everyone completely anonymous when we're reporting on the people. We don't give parents names. We don't even post the pictures of them. Everything's blurred out. So if all we're doing is sharing the advice that people are giving to the parents who are coming with their children who are claiming to be trans, like that should be valuable information. To the fact that so many people in these groups are scrambling to like find the mole or to you know, to find out where we are and to shame us from doing this type of stuff, it's really indicative that, you know, maybe they think that they're not quite doing such good things. Otherwise, why would they care if we're sharing the anonymous advice given on a forum that's meant to help people?
Right. If they believe the advice is valid and mm-hmm. works, why is it a bad thing that
we're not
people are sharing
exposing
it?
Anyone's privacy? I mean, it's valuable stories, you think.
So what were some of the other videos that they removed? There's one here about that's called What You Need to Know Before Phalloplasty Surgery. What's phalloplasty surgery?
It's creating a penis from, you can either have it created like a sort of a pseudo, one thing, it's not a real penis though, it's a pseudo penis. Sometimes they're created from sort of surrounding genital tissue. And then sometimes they'll take sort of a skin graft from a place like your forearm or your inner leg or something, inner thigh, and they'll use that to create sort of this makeshift penis. So that's what a phalloplasty is.
Can you guys, I see some people in the chat are talking about Tavistock. Are you guys familiar with what happened there with them closing this gender affirming clinic? Are you comfortable telling people about a little bit about that?
Yeah, I am. So there was a clinic called GIDS, G-I-D-S. You know, I can't actually remember what that stands for off the top of my head, but that was sort of the gender clinic. It was at the Tavistock Center, which is the UK's clinic where they give like the gender affirming care. They treat kids who claim to have gender dysphoria. There was only one in the UK that serviced all these different areas. So they came under fire a lot because of whistleblowers within the organization claiming that, you know, they're not having proper balance of safeguarding against kids. They had Kira Bell incident, who was, this girl who was transitioning to a boy and later came to regret it and detransitioned and said that, you know, they were only given like an hour or so of therapy before they were just put on this pathway to a full sex change. So recently they shut down the Tavistock Center, the one that's dealing with the gender clinics, partially because there was a big review called the CAS review that went and reviewed all the literature on gender affirming care and just saw red flags popping up everywhere. So they're sort of both closing it down. Now, if you ask some of the gender activists, they'll say like, well, they're going to be opening up a bunch more of these gender clinics across the country. So it's actually going to be better because, you know, it's going to be able to better provide access to people in more rural regions of the UK. That's true, but they're also going to be changing and revamping the way that they approach these kids who have gender dysphoria. It's not going to be all just affirmation from day one, you're actually born in the wrong body type of stuff. They're going to be trying to do a very like therapy first type of session, exploring different aspects of what could be causing this. Is your dysphoria, is that the result of all these comorbidities, or is the comorbidities a result of your dysphoria? Right now, kids are just going there and, you know, the second they say the word gender, they're just, you know, all their problems are sort of collapsed into this one root issue of like, oh, it's because you're trans. And so they just try to treat the dysphoria, which is probably more of a symptom. So that's what's going on in the UK. They've become very sane on this issue lately, and they're getting a lot done with respect to the US and Canada.
We'll get there. If we just keep at it, we'll get there. Go ahead.
I was going to say, do you think that that's true, Christina? Do you think that we're on the Boston Children's Hospital hiding these videos I want to think that maybe they're realizing there are some problems here with this just completely affirming approach. Do you think that we're heading in that direction as well, like Sweden and Finland? And
I think we are, but I think we need to do a better job of organizing and working together. And I think one of the best things that we can do is discredit the social sciences, because that is where all of this came from. And if you look at the grievance studies affair, where James and Helen and Peter exposed like the frivolous scholarship, how easy it is to hoax these postmodern social science journals. It's it's complete nonsense. This whole idea of a gender identity, it's just amazing to me how so many people believe it. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely insane that, like, I think we can do a better job of, like, discrediting the social sciences, because most of, 90% of it is just absolute insanity, garbage. Like, they're not smart. Like, they're people who couldn't get into the actual sciences, and so they went this route, and they just sit around making shit up all the time.
But they have a very good influence, though, on the sciences,
because they are credentialed with doctorate degrees. People say, "Oh, we should listen to what these people say about gender because they are studied gender their whole life and they know everything about it. They have a doctorate. Look at all these research they did on gender." Like, it's just like this complete made up fucking thing. Like, and now we're medicalizing children based on it. It's absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an important thing to think about, is what happens when the legitimizing and credentialing institutions become captured by a certain ideology, because, you know, it makes you sound like the conspiracy theorist tinfoil hat person when parents come to you and they say, you know, where should I go? And you say, well, don't go to the therapist, don't go to the gender clinic, because they're the crazy ones. It's just like, well, where do you go? You trust some guy on the internet who's got a Substack and a YouTube channel? Like, that's kind of what we're forced to do now, but it still remains true that, yeah, these institutions have been captured. You know, there was an article that was written by Jack Turbin, who's sort of this gender activist physician guy who goes, he writes a lot of sort of big papers in high impact journals, but the peer review process, I guess, or lack thereof, it's non-existent, because the methods and the analyses he uses are just debunked instantly, and people are sending. I'm in some groups, Society for Evidence-Based Gender Medicine, and a lot of these people, they're brilliant. They're in this field too, and they'll submit comments, you know, an hour after these articles are released, saying like, "There's some major issues with this study."
But that information doesn't get rejected.
Exactly.
It's the problem. Like, that's what we need to do. We need to, like, make this information easily accessible to the public, because there's this barrier from, like, the academic elite side of the humanities and social science departments, where they throw out all these big words like, "Oh, well, I did my dissertation on my autoethnography," and fucking, like,
and the public doesn't know. It just, it's like a pseudo-intellectual. It's meant to
absolutely exclude people. It's pseudo-intellectualism. Like, they're fucking idiots. Like, they just are. Like, they couldn't do anything else with their lives, so they decided to sit around talking about making things up, like, about gender. And now we're all dealing with the consequences of it. And
so,
sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Finish your thought.
I forgot.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, so this group that you're talking about, and Christina, you're saying we need to get this information out to the public. The group that you're talking about, Colin, I think you said it's the Society for Gender-Based Medicine, for example.
Yes,
and you'll have
evidence-based gender medicine.
Yeah. Evidence-based gender medicine. So you're saying there will be scientists in there who challenge some of these studies that are coming out. Is that those scientists who are challenging it, are they... why isn't their stuff getting out into the public? Why isn't the criticism getting out into the public? Is there a fear of still in the medical establishment of challenging this stuff?
Well, there is, not within this group specifically. They're out there writing the papers and the responses and the comments to all this, you know, frankly, fraudulent research that's being put out there, or at least stuff that wouldn't pass muster in any other field if it weren't completely captured. And what happens, though, is you have, you know, I've been in the peer review process before. You have an editor that's at a certain journal. You get someone who submits it. What your job as the editor is to find, reviewers for this. And hopefully you'd find someone who might disagree with a little bit, somewhere to give good constructive feedback. Well, the problem is they'll get a paper from someone like Jack Turbin, who's, you know, gender affirmation. And then the editors are all about gender affirmation. And they don't really have anyone to send it to who isn't all for gender affirmation. And so these things just slide through without any pushback whatsoever. And then when you have someone in SCGM, the society that I'm a part of, who will submit these critiques, these really valid critiques and evidence-based, and they'll show their analyses and show all their work. They send them to the editor. The editor looks at them. They're not even sent out for review. These are just rejected as soon as they get into the inbox. Sometimes they literally get rejected an hour after they've submitted these papers. So you can't even possibly read the paper and analyze it enough to know that this is not even something you want to entertain at your journal.
Right. The thing I remembered what I wanted to say. Okay. We have to be able to teach the public, you know, who aren't involved in politics, who will, you know, maybe they watch like the news, MSNBC or something like that, and they don't hear about any of this stuff. Like, we have to be able to tell people, like, it kind of is a conspiracy with, and it involves the mainstream media, and academics and medical institutions and the government. It is kind of like a conspiracy. Like, and we have to be able to ask people, like, just suspend your disbelief and listen to us. Like, this is happening.
Or stop assuming that the government or the field of medicine always has your best interests at heart. And all you have to do to recognize that, I think, is look at history. Look at things like the Tuskegee experiments. Look at eugenics and how the government, the medical establishment, all of these organizations were pushing eugenics at one point. Like, that
people don't always want to be bothered by scandals. They want to continue to live their life and be able to dismiss us. Like, they want to be able to, you know, MSNBC will tell them, like, no, there's nothing going on here. No, those are just crazy, hateful bigots just doing what they always do.
You know, I'd like to point out the weird world that we live in too, because it wasn't that long ago. In fact, it was just a couple of years ago that it was really mainly people on the political left who were doing the major critiques of big pharma and over medicalizing, you know, kids and being put on Adderall and Ritalin and all this stuff and talking about the financial incentives from this. And then as soon as the pandemic hit, it just flipped completely. Now it's like all the people on the left who were previously very critical of this big pharma are now just like, trust the experts. Like, these are there's no incentives to be worried about whatsoever. Even though a little Lupron Depot shot you get implanted in you, that can cost like $40,000 and it only lasts about a year. So, I mean, there's insane money to be made from this. And the fact that people just gloss over this because someone just said the magic word gender or they saw a rainbow flag, like, it's just... Yeah. Completely insane.
Boston's Children's Hospital, they're funded by taxpayers. Medicaid covers all of those expensive surgeries that are like, what was it, like phalloplasty is like $20,000 to $40,000, and it's all state funded. Like, anyone can go and get gender affirmation surgery. There's even, Colin showed me this a week or something ago. I've been wanting to report on it. Like, insurance will cover like these like Dr. Frankenstein looking surgeries. You can like get your private parts to look like a Ken doll.
What? You can get
everything removed. Yeah.
There's a non-binary
surgery that they promote to people. Or you can get like this hermaphroditic surgery where you have like this little penis and a vagina with it or something like that. Like, they promote this stuff and it's all taxpayer funded because it's in the name of gender affirmation and you can't discriminate against someone's gender identity.
They hide it in that sort of, if you oppose bullying and you oppose discrimination, then you will support this. They hide it in that sort of that empathy.
Yeah.
What did you say the Ken doll surgery is called?
It's called the gender or sex nullification surgery. Sometimes they'll, with the chest, they'll do it where they'll remove the nipples and everything too. So you like the complete, you know, just bare skin chest. And then they'll do something down below as well, where they don't create a vagina. They're not creating a penis. They're just sort of creating this. I mean, sometimes the descriptions, it's just like a generally smooth appearance from like top to bottom. It's just like this null void area that's neither male or female sexed or
anything. And they portray it in a way like this is what non-binary people are supposed to look like.
Like you can identify with that. You know, this is just like surgeries a la carte. You can just pick what you want. These are by no means medically necessary. It's just they found a niche where they can just, again, say those magic words, gender.
And then something to say about like the sunk cost fallacy, or like it's not that different from like when people, you know, like end up getting like tons of tattoos and piercings. Like you get one and then it's like, oh, what am I going to do next? You know, like what's gender? It's almost like you start someplace changing your pronouns and your name, and then you cut your hair, and then like, oh, what's the next thing? And everybody in the community is just sort of like taking these next steps, and you think like, oh, well, what am I going to do next? Yeah. You know, what's next for me? Like, and then it ends up being like a genital surgery.
Yeah. That strikes me what you're calling the sunken cost fallacy, the sunken cost of getting so invested in these choices and doing that with kids. Sarah Higdon, who I've had on the show before, who's a trans woman, a YouTuber, and has spoken out against the gender affirming care for children, like the medical and surgical interventions, just wrote a piece about this, about the sunken cost thing. And it's sort of when you're a kid and you're immediately validating, like in these groups that you guys are in, the parents are told immediately validate, immediately change the pronouns, immediately socially transition them. And then they start pushing the medical intervention, Lupron, which you mentioned, which they use to block puberty, is one of those drugs, and they start pushing all that, and there's that sunken cost of the kid has now invested so much in this in terms of parents getting on board. Sometimes the parents have big breakups with the grandparents or with other family members. There's this whole like coming out thing that happens. The family is now invested maybe a year sometimes in saying, no, this is who my child is. You have to use this name. You have to use these pronouns. For the kid then to say, I changed my mind after the parent, you know, it's a lot of pressure and responsibility to put on these kids.
Yeah. Well, I remember growing up when, you know, goths were a thing, and I don't know how old you are, but was there like the trend of kids who were like gauging their ears? They put the little things and they try to expand them out, you know, sort of that tribal thing. And, you know, some kids would get these piercings before they were 18, and it was always like, oh, you're going to regret these things. That was seen as like the most extreme body modification, at least when I was growing up in high school. And, you know, I've had friends who had like the big earlobes, and they went and then got them surgically reattached because they were no longer into that when they're 30 years old. Imagine that. but the surgery looks great. You can barely even tell that they have these loops. So as far as like reconstructive surgery goes, like expanding your earlobes, like it's pretty benign. We've gone just completely bonkers with the types of things we're allowing kids to do. Whereas before we'd urge them maybe not to gauge your ears. Now we're just sort of fast tracking them to things that are, you know, double mastectomies. Like talk about a sunk cost fallacy. Like you've had your breast removed when you're 13 years old. Yeah. Like there's no coming back from that. Like
you're all in.
It's all based on this religion that these parents have subscribed to, and they implant this belief in their kid that if they like things from the opposite sex's stereotypes, they can be a different sex trapped in their whatever. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's all based on stereotypes when it comes down to it, the way they talk about it.
Have you guys seen the documentary Transhood? This came out a year or two ago. Transhood. It's on HBO. It's actually, now I know there were some conservatives who at the time were calling for a boycott of it, or like, you know, don't watch this documentary. They followed four so-called trans kids in this documentary over a period of, I think, 4 years. And I think the documentary is great because it shines a light on a lot of these dynamics in the families that you're talking about, where the kid has the sunk cost thing going on. The parents are so heavily invested. You can also see how the parents in a couple of the cases are pushing it on their kids.
Yeah, it makes it special.
Yes. And you can, and it's sort of, even though they didn't intend, I don't think, to show this, it's very clear. I think everyone should go watch Transhood. And there is one, just an example in that documentary. There's an example of a mom who, her 13-year-old daughter is now a boy, right? Or they say is transitioning to a boy. And they've started the Lupron, or I think she's 12, actually. They've started giving her the puberty blockers, and they've started talking about taking testosterone. And there's one part where the mom meets this woman, and they decide within just a couple of months that they're going to get married. And there's a scene where she sits down and tells the kid, now we're getting married because her insurance will cover all of the gender affirming care that you need. And that weight, that pressure to put on that kid, where it's like, if that kid ever changes her mind and is like, I want to stop all of this. I don't want the surgery. It's like, my mom got married for me to have this surgery, you know, to have the insurance.
The case study that we talked about this last time. One of the case studies that Colin and I did, where there was pressure for the daughter to get her mastectomy at 14. Mm-hmm. And it did have to do with like getting married, the mom getting married and the insurance changing. And then thankfully the girl didn't go through with it. She was rushed into it.
And then the mom said
in the hospital, she said
that she didn't pressure her daughter more to go through with it.
Yeah, she said that after.
She said she did not pressure her.
She said she was regretful for not pressuring her daughter to go through with it more, because she was, you know, she thought it would just be really great for her. And
The reason why it's a religion is because it's all based on beliefs. Beliefs, not facts, not biological reality. Like, there's no like, there's sex, there's biological sex, there's not really, gender is something like you can understand as you explain it, Colin.
Yeah, well, it really depends on what the people, how they choose to define it, because a lot of times, and in these videos for the Boston Children's Hospital is a good example, because there's maybe like 4 or 5 videos where they say, what does it mean to be transgender? And they're like these little 40-second videos. And I watched all of them, and they're completely undecipherable. They say, you know, if your sex assigned at birth is different from your gender identity, and you can kind of pick apart what they mean by gender identity, because they'll talk about like the binary. So I guess something for people who aren't aware of just like what these people actually believe about this is that they think that there's this gender binary. And this is actually very different from the sex binary. When they say gender binary, they're talking about man and woman as these social roles and expectations that are placed on individuals because of their perceived sex. Okay. And so it can be broadly construed as like masculinity and femininity. That's the binary. And if you're transgender, so they also have this weird conspiracy theory that when you're born, a doctor is assigning you a gender identity. You're assigned gender, which is, you know, the doctor, by looking at your genitals, they'll say, this is a boy. In their interpretation, boy means this is going to be raised by the social norms and expectations that we commonly place on males, that type of thing. Doctors aren't really doing that, but this is what these people believe. And they think that trans people fall into 2 categories. You can be within the binary. And that means you're male, but you identify with the roles and expectations associated with being female, or vice versa. Or you can be a non-binary trans person, and you don't identify with the roles and expectations with regard to either sex. And so when you have that background knowledge going into these videos, and the kids certainly don't understand this. These are children. Most adults don't understand this unless you know what they actually talk about when they're using these terms. It's completely cryptic. It just sounds like, you know, you identify with the as a boy.
And Colin and I have tried in webinars, he's tried to like in the comment section when they have like Q&A and stuff like that, he's tried to get them to like pinpoint what their philosophy is, and they're like, oh, that's a great question, and then they don't answer it.
They don't. Yeah.
No. So I mean, they play fast and loose with gender and sex, and they'll switch between them both. I don't even know if they're aware of what they're doing. I mean, I suspect a lot of them probably are. But yeah, it's completely ideological and based on the stereotypes that you exist. So we're kind of, it's almost like a new type of conversion therapy, the way that I see it, because before you'd have, you know, these kids who are gender nonconforming, they're more likely to be homosexual. And before, the old school type of conversion therapy was saying like, oh, you're attracted to the same sex, there's something wrong with your mind, we're going to try to change your mind to match your body. But we've just sort of flipped that on its head with gender ideology. Now we see a gender nonconforming kid and we say, oh, you're maybe born in the wrong body. We can modify your body with hormones and surgeries to better reflect your brain now. So again, it's the same thing. We're trying to make someone straight, but before we tried to change their mind, now we're trying to change their bodies.
Yeah. And yeah. Colin has said too, it's like an immaterial soul. It's like, it's a good way to compare it. Yeah, gender identity. It's like an immaterial soul. It lives in you. And if it differs from your body, you can correct your body to match your gender identity.
You're exactly right that it's so much like conversion therapy, but it's worse. It's physical modification and sterilization of kids, which is so much worse than the conversion therapy that the left has been criticizing for a few decades, which was more about changing, more about psychology and behavior and trying to modify a person's attraction. Now they're just like, we're literally going to just take out your body parts, make it so you can't have kids ever. Other irreversible damage.
It's conversion therapy on steroids, both literally and figuratively. In this
And that's why people don't believe us too, is because they associate conversion therapy with fundamentalist Christians and Republicans. And so they assume that since conservatives are the ones who are against all of these, you know, they call them like anti-trans laws and things like that. Like they assume like it isn't for the reasons
that we
shared.
They're too locked into that right-left dichotomy. They can't ever be seen to agree with someone who's a Christian conservative on the right. You know, it's like, how could I do? I must be on the other side, I guess. I must be for mastectomies for kids because the conservatives are against it.
Like, no one wants to be associated with being a Trump voter, and we're both not Trump voters. I didn't vote for Trump. And you know, we see this in the comments a lot. They're just like, oh, you know, you're
far right.
You're far right. You support Trump, all this stuff. I'm like, I've never voted Republican my whole life. I'm not a Christian. I'm an atheist. You know, there's many boxes that I would check for being, you know, if you just gave me a survey, well, actually any survey I've ever taken, like a political compass test, puts me squarely on the left here. So in a way, we're kind of even more, I don't know, dangerous in that sense, because we really break the script that they are reading from, because they assume so much about us and none of it is really true. So in a way, that makes us hard villains, because we're just saying like really plainly true things without a lot of ideological.
I was a social justice warrior just like a year.
That sounds like something a conservative Christian would say, though. I'm kidding. You must be. I do have a super chat here from, I didn't miss it. I saw it. Where's it at? I think it was from Ian. Let me see if I can find it. And he recommended an article. There it is. Oh, no, it's from Andrew. Thank you, Andrew Joyner. He says, an interesting article from The Guardian from 2020 called The Government Gender Identity Guidance for Teachers. It tells teachers that it's maybe not a good idea to tell kids they're born in the wrong body. Oh, really? That's actually surprising. I want to read that piece.
Yeah, there was a little bit of, what was the group? Mermaids or something. They're trying to back away from born in the wrong body rhetoric, which is really funny because they've been pushing that line for so long. And then there was all of a sudden people complained about it. And then people complained about that. And then all of a sudden you would go on their websites and all indications of born in the wrong body stuff was like erased from these different areas. And they pretended like they had never promoted this idea. And they're like, no, it's kind of an overgeneralization to say that. But it's like, this was like the backbone of what you were telling kids and their parents for over a decade. And they're just trying to like, you know, gaslight everyone that, no, they never really actually said this type of thing. So.
They're on to sex as a spectrum now, and there's all this evidence to prove it, but it's all bonk.
Yeah. Just a couple of other chats, guys. These are not super chats, but Nerdy says, Christina's a firecracker. I love it. Thanks, Nerdy Girl. And Pirate wants you to make sure you affirm the like button. Yes, if you like the show, affirm that button. There you go. I found that piece. We can look at it if you want. But I also, before I do that, I wanted to bring this up since we're talking about the medical establishment and trying to help wake up normal people, I guess, to understand that the government and the medical establishment are not always operating with our best interests at heart. This happened earlier this year. And where is it? Here it is. Now, this is a piece that's actually supportive of these changes. This is, I guess, a social justice person who's very happy about all this, but it's about the DSM 5 and how they changed the definition of gender dysphoria, mm-hmm. and they changed a lot of other things about
gender identity disorder, and they changed it, right?
Yeah.
So it's not a disorder, it's just a difference now. They do the same thing with, like, I'm okay with, because I'm on the autism spectrum. They call that neurodiversity now. It's not like a disorder. It's just a brain difference, which, yeah, to some degree, but it also makes, it's also creates a lot of challenges for people. And like, I get the idea they want to make it so that people, there's less stigma attached or people feel better about themselves, but applying that to gender identity, like it's a recipe for disaster. Like it's not just a difference. Like it is a mental illness. And I just got a freaking comment removed for hate speech for saying something like that on Instagram.
If you look at the language on this article too, you know, they're actually trying to move away from gender dysphoria, and they're trying to say, you know, gender variance, or I think in the DSM-5, the newer version they're going to do, it's going to get rid of gender dysphoria, and this is going to call it like gender incongruence or something.
Yeah, my goodness.
And everything is like gender affirming this, gender incongruence.
They keep taking it further and further and further. Like that's what they do. Like they don't, there's no, we have to push back. They're just going to keep going. Then it's going to turn age.
Age dysphoria, and then age dysphoria is not enough. Now it's
It's just as crazy as what we're doing with the trans stuff. I mean, there's people laugh at like trans ageism. It's like, why is that any less crazy? I mean, I used to be a child. I at least kind of remember what it was like to be a kid. I've never been a woman before. I couldn't possibly know how that feels. So yeah, it's some people, I mean, old people, like, oh, I hear like old people say, I feel 24 on the inside or something like that. Like, yeah. And in a sense, you know, they remember, they have these memories. So it's way more plausible for like trans ageism than.
It's completely plausible. I mean, in this piece, I'm going to read a little bit of this. They, one of the language changes they did in the DSM is they changed preferred gender to experienced gender, which if you think about that, what they're doing with language, they're validating immediately with the language. They're saying experience. We are saying you do experience this. Somebody could say the same about age. Like you guys are saying, my experienced age is 21, you know, and so I am 21.
They changed. I mean, they got Merriam-Webster to change the definition of racism to fit their narrative. Yep. We kept getting, you know, they kept losing arguments. Like, well, that's not the dictionary definition of racism. Like, oh, well, now it is. We changed
it. We changed it, yeah.
Female and male, too, recently.
Yeah. Let me read through just a little of this, and we can talk about it. So this, again, this is a piece that supports these changes. It's called What the 2022 Changes in the DSM-5 Mean If You're Trans. And then the subheadline is, that's one small step for gender variance, one giant leap for humankind. And so here we go. As of March 2022, the APA released a series of blink and you'll miss them updates to the DSM-5 through a text revision. Thankfully, I read them and I am delighted to share with you just how helpful these tiny changes will be for trans, queer, and all gender nonconforming people.
Gender nonconforming. That's just added right there. Don't even shy away from saying that anymore, including them in there.
Yeah, they just put it right in there. So they go on to explain what the DSM-5 is. It's the book that the American Psychiatric Association publishes for medical professionals, which has a list of all these different disorders you might be experiencing. So it says, this person's opinion is that the DSM-4 offered people with transgender experiences the diagnosis of gender identity disorder, and they say that this did a lot of damage. What the DSM-5 changes did to help. They say the DSM-5, the diagnosis of gender identity disorder was officially dead and replaced with gender dysphoria. And so here's some of this. You can read from the APA. It says the terminology and the gender dysphoria specifiers has been updated in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, fifth edition. And these updates were endorsed by the DSM Steering Committee, the APA Assembly, and the Board of Trustees to use culturally sensitive and less stigmatizing language. There's what you're talking about, Christina. They say they're doing this to be less stigmatizing. So yeah.
They actually some of these, the same thing. Asperger's, but turning it into autism spectrum disorder so that the people who are in lower functioning autism feel less bad. But you actually can't say high functioning or low functioning anymore because that also makes them feel bad.
Oh. Do you guys remember the old George Carlin bit where he's talking about what that used to be called shell shock? When you and then they called it post-traumatic stress disorder, and then they called it, I forget, eventually it's like 20 words. Okay. It's just,
yeah, language evolves over time because certain words attract stigma.
Yeah, you know, a lot of what this language does, like they'll have their rationale for change because it's more inclusive or something like that, but what it in effect does is it prevents people who are just coming to this, who don't know the lingo, they don't know what's going on. They don't know that taking, you know, your experience gender or taking, you know, gender assigned at male at birth and you can't say natal female. I mean, this is making it so people can't actually refer to reality in simple terms because it's all just, you know, these layers of euphemism you have.
And so they can ban us for saying things like Google.
Oh, yeah. So they can ban you if you use what they say has now been deemed, you know, offensive. So here are some of those changes. They said rationale for change. The text of gender dysphoria was updated to use culturally sensitive language, e.g. desired gender was changed to experienced gender. Cross-sex medical procedure was updated to gender-affirming medical procedure. Why would they do that? Why would they take cross-sex medical procedure and change it to gender-affirming medical procedure?
Well, I mean, if they're just defining what someone's gender is according to stereotypes in their mind, it's just like, you know, being gender nonconforming, why wouldn't you affirm that? There's nothing wrong with that. But then that just like slides in the ideological component that there is a right way and a wrong way for you to behave based on your physical anatomy type of thing. And so there's a mismatch that we can be fixed.
Sex changes for kids just doesn't sound as nice as gender affirming medical care.
Yes. Cross-sex, they want to get rid of that when they're doing it for kids. It's like the softening of the language to get rid of. They don't even like when you use the words mastectomy to describe.
Top surgery and bottom surgery. Cute.
Top surgery. Yeah, you're exactly right. This one I think is one of the most insidious. Here, they changed natal male to individual assigned male at birth.
Yeah, they go back and forth between assigned, you know, assigned male or assigned sex. They'll kind of alternate between those interchangeably.
Something else I wanted to bring up that like it. This story I did like didn't get as much attention as I thought it should. I have no idea why because it's about a pedophile. Redux originally reported on it, and then I got assigned to do it. From Postmillennial, and it's this fucking guy from the University of Manchester who they allowed to masturbate to child porn for 3 months for his like PhD research, and he writes about it in detail, and it's just an incredible story to me.
And he published this stuff in peer reviewed
published it. Peer-reviewed article details about like, oh, and then it's fantasy porn, so it's they're comics, but they depict young boys. And he's like, oh, and then the young boy touched his cock, and I came, like, and that's his research. He makes a journal entry of all the different scenarios that made him orgasm.
I'm the exiled academic here, and he's happily sitting within the university.
This is what the social sciences is. They're like, but they use all of this terminology. Like, what was the term that they used for it? Was that an autoethnography or what?
Yeah, it's a common term in like cultural anthropology, autoethnography, which is literally just sort of a stream of consciousness, how it made me feel, that they publish as, you know, parts or the entirety of their dissertations.
Yeah.
They call it science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a qualitative science.
Yeah, qualitative method, which is bullshit.
It's one thing to like take other people's sort of experiences and compile them and look for similarities and differences.
He chose to masturbate himself looking at child porn, and they called that science, and it got published, and he made a documentary about it, and it won an award. Like,
and this is crazy. I didn't even see this. You're right. I didn't see this story of yours.
It should have. Like, I think it's just more evidence, like, that the social sciences is just, they're completely untrustworthy. And more people need to know about it. Like,
this is the piece you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. I told James Lindsay about it. He said that that was one of their hoax papers, but for adult porn, not child porn. It exposed, like, how ridiculous, like, their research methods are.
Wow. Okay. Well, we'll share this link for anyone who wants to read about this guy, this PhD candidate. If anybody wants to have a disgusting Friday.
It made me sick. It made me sick to write about, because Redux originally reported on it. They did a great job. And like, they have more details than I could stomach to include in this one, where his research, like, is just excerpts from his masturbation journal about what turned him on the most and made him come.
To get back to what you're talking about with the social sciences, and these people are being pushed out as experts, all these PhDs. Yeah, they don't know that they put a lot of fancy words on it. They try and make it sound over your head. They use words like, what did you call it?
Autoethnography.
Autoethnography. Okay. And then I think normal everyday people who are raising kids and going to work and they hear something like that, and they're like, I guess I'm not smart enough to understand it. No, that's not true. They're trying to exclude you from understanding them.
Google search autoethnography, and it's all these other fancy words to describe, oh, this is a qualitative research method that blah, blah, blah. Like, no, it's just bullshit. Just stream of thought.
They use those words to exclude you from understanding, so that you think that you're not smart enough to get it. Because if they explained it in words that you could understand, you would realize they're full of crap. That's why.
And Colin and I have talked about having our own education site or our own organization that looks at a lot of this horrible research coming from, and, you know, being kind of like a watchdog from the social sciences and explaining, making like really easy to understand bullet point infographic type things on, so people can be better informed and prepared on how to handle this stuff when they go to their school board meetings and stuff like that.
I think it's a great idea,
but like, someone has to pay for it because we have to work, so
yeah.
Someone has to help fund it.
Yeah,
there's so much coming every day too. It's overwhelming
I want to talk about something I saw, and I'm in some of these same groups that you're in, because I like to just keep an eye on where things are headed in terms of I do think of it as a cult, this cult of, you know, pushing parents into automatically this orthodoxy of automatically affirming everything and get rushing their kids into medical transitioning. In that group, I just saw a heartbreaking post a couple days ago. I see posts like this on the regular in these groups, though. And this was a mom who posted a picture of her kid and said, you know, unfortunately, something to the effect of my child killed themselves.
Oh, and my God.
She said, we did every, it was one of these other ones where she says, we did everything right. They had a loving family who supported them and supported all their choices and affirmed. And we, you know, basically we did everything we're supposed to do. And my kids still killed themselves. And if you read through the comments on that post, which is a heartbreaking post, they don't have any self-awareness about, well, maybe what you're calling the right things, we did the right things, are not the right things. Maybe it didn't help.
I think about that too, about like what could really be driving trans people to kill themselves. It's like, maybe they realized they made a mistake and there's no way to fix it. And they protested for so long that they are what they are, and then they realize they aren't. And like, how do you live after that when you're a young
person?
Maybe
there's underlying problems that you never addressed.
Because
you guys said, when they go in with the gender affirming care, it's immediately, well, if we change your biological sex, then all your problems will go away. Yeah. But what happens when that's not the case?
Well, I think we're just doing the exact opposite in many cases of what you would have sort of like a cognitive behavioral therapist do. We're teaching them to just really drill down and lean into their, into dissociating from their physical bodies. And especially when this starts with kids that are at a very young age, when you tell them that you're, you know, tell a little boy that you're a little girl and that you can grow up to be a woman, they probably think they can literally grow up and be just like their mom. And then when they kind of, you know, realize that, oh no, I'm going to be essentially just like this butchered individual who's going to maybe take on some of these characteristics, but you'll always be this, you're never going to be there no matter what. I mean, I don't know what would drive me to kill myself, but I can sort of imagine me really considering thinking about it if this is the
state. It's a hard time seeing past childhood too. Like, when I was a teenager, I wanted to kill myself too. I couldn't see into adulthood and that, you know, my life was going to change so much throughout the years, and I'm just going to keep becoming an evolved different person. Like, when you're a teenager, like, you can't see out of being a teenager and out of your current situation, and it's so overwhelming. And
yeah,
Lior Sapir did a great piece in Collins' Substack about the affirm or suicide myth, and this completely debunked their theories and their studies about it.
Colin, what is your Substack again?
It's realitieslaststand.com.
Realities Last Stand. Pirate Tomsky's here today. Hello, Pirate. I see you in the chat. If you could drop a link to his Substack, I think you may have already done so. But thank you very much. We do have a couple super chats. One from Adam Coleman. Hello, sir. Hey, Adam.
Who's hanging Adam. Out?
Wrong speak. Adam is here. He says, three awesome people on one live stream. Christina, great work on human events. Keep speaking out, everyone. Thank you so much. And then Noah N. gives a super chat and says, Genevieve Gluck article on the origins of DSM-5 changes in Redux Mag, tied to creators, eunuch maker of ShockVid Pain Olympics, must read. Thank you for that.
Redux has some amazing articles. I don't know how they find this stuff. I just saw one the other day. It was actually older, but it was talking about this like pedophile chat group that they monitor, this old school message board. And I clicked on it and like, it's very real. Like, I saw some like horrifying things there. It's very active. There's a lot of pedophiles out there who believe that society is sick and they're in the right, and that society shames kids for wanting to be sexual and have relationships with older men. It's so disturbing.
I think those people are becoming more emboldened.
They are.
Yeah, I think they think society's like shifting towards acceptance of them.
That video that Libs of TikTok just shared, that actually did come from a Redux article, actually, originally. That's what I was looking at. Is, yeah, their pedophiles are marginalized and victimized. Like, it's, that's the direction we're going. Like, with social sciences, like, they have to keep pushing. They're like, oh, what's my research going to be about? Like, oh, well, let's just apply this to this over here and then push to get this accepted. And that's where we are right now.
Yeah.
That's social science.
Can we back up a second to something you said at the beginning, Christina? You guys referenced, you said they're following a lot of these hospitals and stuff that are providing this gender affirming care, that they're following the W path. Is that what you said? What is the W path?
World Professional Association for Transgender Health, I think is what that stands for.
Okay.
I don't know how I just pulled that out, but I think that's what it is.
Okay.
But yeah, and the thing to point out though is that these things are guidelines. They're not like enforceable. They're just sort of a group of physicians or therapists. This is like their,
who are ideologically
what
captured.
They recommend, but they can be broken by, you know, individual case by case basis.
Who trust the authority of the, you know, experts, the doctors of gender from their social science departments who have studied it, just basically sitting around making shit up.
I don't know if you follow Eva Korolova on Twitter.
Sounds
but she
familiar.
Wrote a great piece about how she would have been trans when she was a kid. And she went through the DSM-5 and she had a really good point because, well, one, even if you just follow the DSM-5 and how they diagnose gender dysphoria for kids, you know, she was a very gender nonconforming kid and she's like, I would have fit all of the requirements for sure. Like, no question. And then like, but even if you didn't, even if you like have a physician who's following this DM5, which seems to like set out some criteria that people will cite when they say, no, kids can't do this, you need to fit these criteria. Well, actually you don't. There's just a complete walk around for these entire criteria, which is gender affirmation. You just, the kid walks in, you don't even have to fulfill any of these because the doctor can't tell you that you're not what you say you are. So that's just, what's the point of having the DSM-5 and like, you know, you need to have any three of these plus, you know, number two must be present, when gender affirmation just throws all of that out the window the second you walk in the door and say you're trans.
Crazy ideas that gullible parents believe and then gullible parents teach their kids.
This is in that same piece we were reading from, the person who was happy about the DSM changes. They said exactly what you're talking about here. They said no dysphoria required anymore. So in addition to the new diagnosis, the DSM-5 includes very clear and strong language that, quote, not all individuals who identify as transgender will experience dysphoria regarding their gender identity. So what does that mean? They don't even feel like they were born in the wrong body. But
yeah. It's just because, again, that's what the binary, they're just not identifying with those social constructs of masculinity and femininity, which, I mean, there's a biological basis, but again, they're just rejecting the stereotypes. Like, that's all it is.
Gender identity itself.
They deny it. Yeah. So you can be trans now. There's a difference between having a trans identity and having gender dysphoria. Unfortunately, the medical establishment hasn't really caught up to that. You know, they're just, someone says they're trans and immediately it's just like, you're on your gender journey. How about some puberty blockers to buy you time to figure it out for yourself? But what they're figuring out is rooted in stereotypes. And again, the gender nonconforming kids are the ones who just get fast tracked.
They say that the puberty blockers are safe and reversible and a pause button on puberty, but they're referring to their on-label use, which is to treat precocious puberty, not their off-label use that is used to treat gender dysphoria during puberty, during a period of rapid growth and development. And there are no long-term studies done. It's just a medical experiment on kids.
Yeah.
It's a whole lie.
So what can people do if they want to support the work that you guys are doing? And what would you suggest that people do if they want to be more informed just in general? Are there other people you suggest they check out or read, or if they have kids who are maybe saying to them now, like, I think I'm trans, like, what kind of advice would you give?
Well, I would say, you know, there's some people who have really good books on there. Helen Joyce has a book called Trans. Kathleen Stock has a book called Material Girls. These are just really great, like going into the basis of where did gender ideology come from, where it's potentially going, really just exposes the ideology for what it is. A lot of people don't even think they're, you know, the gender ideologues don't even think they have an ideology. They just think this is the way the world is. But so it does a really good job at exposing that. For parents who are aware of this stuff, I would say talk to your kids about this stuff beforehand. Like, don't shy away from talking about what gender ideology is, what they're saying, and why it's insane, because your kids are going to be approached by educators and you're not even going to know about it because they keep these things secret from them.
Look at your state's learning standards.
Yeah.
Our friend Jesse just published this article today in the Chalkboard Review about how you can find out what your state's public school learning standards are and like how activists will sort of take advantage of those to introduce gender pseudoscience to young people.
And if you're able, you know, try to get on school boards. You know, these things need to be crashed by a lot of people who are sick of this ideology, because you can control the school curriculum, what's in and out.
Yes.
So they try to put this stuff weaselly into different areas. That, I mean, sometimes the gender stuff will be in the anti-bullying stuff, which you can't opt out of. Sometimes they'll even put it in the biology lesson. You know, they'll talk about sex and then all of a sudden they'll pivot to gender. And then all of a sudden you're looking at, you know, seahorses and clownfish and how you can change sex. And, you know, it's
now they're trying to introduce it through these gender and sexuality clubs. GSA used to be Gay Straight Alliance. Now it's gender and sexuality clubs. And there's this big effort to push them into like elementary schools too. Mm-hmm. And they're secret clubs. That's one of the things that Colin and I exposed. Chris Rufo just mentioned it in a recent article he wrote. Mm-hmm.
If your kids have a rainbow club or a GSA, and as Christina said, GSA, we actually were shocked to see this because it used to mean Gay Straight Alliance. Now it's Gender and Sexuality Alliance. So
they kept the acronym and changed the words.
Exactly. So you see GSA, like, I remember GSAs. It's like, well, it's a whole different game. Rainbow clubs, GSA clubs. One of the stories that we both did, one of our case studies, showed that, you know, they have to send like some sort of notification home with the kids that these clubs are there. But they even said verbatim, like, they purposefully leave them broad. Like, they'll say the club is about inclusion and acceptance.
Yes.
And then when in reality it's a gender and sexual, they're talking explicitly about sexuality to these kids. And, you know, this is what, but they think they're doing a good thing because the kids need to be here. They need to be protected, you know, from their own parents.
Yeah. They try and hide them. Sometimes they call them anti-bullying, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, my kid's in an anti-bullying club. One of the things.
SEL, social emotional learning, now that's been corrupted by activists too.
Yeah. One of the things I noticed in these parents groups is, and this is just striking to me, and I don't see how they can't see it. I've seen posts where they'll say, you know, my kid is trans and he's in his friend group of five, there's three others who are trans. And anyway, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that is not normal. Okay. No. High of an incidence of kids with gender dysphoria. And like, that is not normal.
They introduce it Wake to them up. When they show them these books about you. I mean, you show a kid a book about, you know, a kid who's trans who switches from boy to a girl or a girl to a boy or something like that. They're going to think they're going to be able to do that too. They introduce this stuff to them. It's not just acceptance. Like, we shouldn't be accepting of it. Like, it's insanity. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's giving your kid a disorder when they normally would just grow up to be gay or something like that. Like, girls and boys are allowed to like things that, from the opposite sex. They're allowed to. We don't need to carve them up like Jordan Peterson said.
Yeah. I'm going to put this on the screen so people can see it. I really recommend following each of these guys on Substack. Reality's Last Stand is where Colin writes about a lot of these issues. And let's see if I can share this other one. I've got yours pulled up too. Christina, Breaking the Spell of Social Justice. Mm-hmm. So there's that one. Pirate Tomsky has put the links in the chat if you want to go follow these. There's a lot of the case studies you guys are doing where, from these groups to sort of expose the orthodoxy of what the what kind of advice these parents are getting and how they're really only being pushed in one direction of how to deal with their kids who are saying they're trans. One thing I wanted to say, just in case people aren't aware, you guys get a lot of hate for doing this kind of work.
Yeah.
And I'm just appreciative that you're writing about it. And there's so many times I'm in these groups where I'm like, I wish people could see what's happening here. And you're starting to show people what's happening there. And like you said, you're respectful of people's privacy. You don't release private details. You're just simply showing the advice and the case stories, anonymous case stories. But you've picked up some haters and some, I would say, in my opinion, stalkers, people who are pretty obsessed with you for exposing this. Does it give you any pause? Are you going to stop writing about this stuff?
None whatsoever.
Yeah. It's a little, I mean, there are some instances where they would say something like, you know, we know what their address is. And so that, you know, it's a little worrisome. We definitely keep the door locked just in case a crazy were to show up one day, but it doesn't really influence what we're doing and, you know, what we decide to write about. We don't really see any of these things as being third rails and we're just not going to go there. You know, if it's concerning, then, you know, we need to talk about it. The ideology has gotten so prevalent from that gut feeling of people not wanting to, you know, overstep some boundary and have people call them names. So we both get called names hundreds, if not thousands of times a day on on social media. So, you know, it's just, we're just kind of used to it. So it is what it is. I know you've gotten a lot of people hating you too for.
Yeah, there was someone really upset that I had Christina, that I had you on my show, as you know. It took me a while to figure out who that person was. It was like, what, where's this coming from? Like threats. And, you know, it's just, I guess it's a function of just, putting yourself out there and
talking publicly.
Yeah. But it's not all bad. I mean, there's a lot of praise too. So it's,
oh yeah. There's a lot of praise and yeah, you can't have, I mean, if you're going to speak against evil or child abuse, and I do think allowing kids to choose medical and surgical intervention, you know, talking about double mastectomies at the age of 13, stuff like that, I think that's abuse. They're not old enough, just like they're not old enough to consent to sex. Like, so I think if you confront that stuff and you talk about why it's wrong, or you at least not even offer an opinion on it, just show people here's what's happening, you're going to attract those kind of people who are upset that you're putting a light on it. So I'm glad that you're out there doing that, despite all of that. So thank you.
Happy to do it.
Sorry that one of our like parasites have jumped on over to you. It's like contagious.
It's okay. It's fine. So you guys, thank you. I know I've taken up about an hour and a half of your time. I hope people come and check out the work you're doing, and thank you for spending your time and your giving us your insight today.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun. Anytime.
Okay. Oh, Sarah Higdon showed up.
Yeah.
I just saw you, Sarah. Yay.
There she is.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure what she's talking about. The people are having a whole chat going on in the chat. But hi, Sarah. Okay, well, thank you guys. Thanks for this. Has been a live Kerfuffy break. And I'll see you guys on, what's today, Friday? I'll see you on Monday. Oh, I'm very excited. On Tuesday, also, I'm going to be doing a discussion with James Lindsay. That's not our usual day. So I should let everyone know. Tuesday, we're doing a live show with James Lindsay and my pastor, Bradley Helgerson. And we're going to be talking about whether or not this whole cultural war is not also a spiritual war. Should be interesting because James is an atheist and my pastor is clearly a Christian, but I think they agree on a lot. So very excited.
Blow up the chat.
We don't live that far from him, but we haven't like hung out here yet. We've hung out in conferences and stuff. But
oh yeah. You guys are Tennessee people.
He's gone a lot. He does a lot of speaking events. So he is always on the road and planes. I mean,
well, if you guys are ever in Texas, you've got a place to stay. You're welcome. Come hang out in real Texas, get outside of Austin.
Yeah. Same to you if you come to Nashville.
Cool. Thanks, guys. Yeah. Take care.
Have a good one.
Bye.